You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, with South Sudan poised to celebrate its one-year anniversary since independence, we cross live to Juba to gauge the mood with our senior editor, Sophie Grove. Then we'll head to New York to speak to Rajiv Chandrasekaran, author of the superb new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. We'll also be checking in with our filmmaker extraordinaire, Gillian DeBias, who's currently in France, before venturing out and about in our own Marylebone Hood to meet some Swedish neighbours.
In London, there is around 60,000 Swedes, so we sell Swedish food for all the Swedes in London.
And as we come to the end of another hectic production week, we'll cross live to somewhere even closer to home, the editorial floor upstairs, where our editor, Andrew Tuck, will hopefully tell us that all the pages for Mediterraneo have now been sent. And, you know, I'll also play you a song or two. How's that? That's all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says an increasing stream of defectors from the Syrian army are showing that the situation is shifting in the country. Speaking after a meeting of the Friends of Syria in Paris, Mrs. Clinton said she had been cheered by news of the defection of Army General Manaf Talas, a personal friend of President Assad. Mrs. Clinton warned countries not to stand by or allow the regime to continue.
The entire world is now looking to those few nations that still have influence in Damascus. They need to step up and use all their leverage to make sure Assad sees the writing on the wall, sitting on the sidelines, or even worse, enabling the regime's brutality would be a grievous mistake.
In Germany, senior lawmakers from Angela Merkel's Conservatives have warned of growing resentment at perceived concessions by the government on Eurozone bailout schemes. At the summit in late June, Italy's technocrat Prime Minister Mario Monti and Spanish leader Mariano Rajoy overcame Mrs. Merkel's reluctance to use the bailout funds to stabilise bond markets and directly help the banks of struggling Eurozone countries. A spokesman for the Conservatives, Michael Storbgen, told correspondents he believed they were getting near the limit of what the Bundestag and the population were willing to bear. The International Criminal Court member responsible for the son of former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi has said it would not be possible for him to receive a fair trial in his home country. Melinda Taylor, who was detained for 26 days in Zintan in Libya, spoke to reporters.
The rights of my client were irrevocably prejudiced during my visit to Zintan. Amongst other things, the Libyan authorities deliberately misled the defence concerning whether the visit with Mr. Gaddafi would be monitored. They also seized documents which were covered by legal professional privilege and ICC protective orders. It is the position of the defence that these recent events have completely underscored that it would be impossible for Mr. Saif al-Islam Gaddafi to be tried in an independent and impartial manner in Libyan courts.
In other developments, Libyans will tomorrow vote in the first free national elections in more than half a century, amid fears that violence could taint the poll that's meant to usher in a temporary national assembly. Australian Girl Guides have decided to drop references to God and the British Queen from their 50-year-old pledge, choosing instead to be true to themselves and to serve their community and Australia. In changes unveiled this week by the Volunteer Girls Group, members have decided to keep their sashes with badges, but pledges of duty to a Christian God, British monarch and obedience have been consigned to history. New South Wales State Commissioner Belinda Allen explained.
It was very much felt that she wasn't actually the word required, but people can still serve her by serving Australia.
And the move was supported by Girl Guide Irene Simpson.
Not everyone thinks the Queen should be part of Australia still, and not everyone also believes in the God.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. It's just come up to 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
from London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyos. Siin on Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Lontoosta käsin, tämä on Monocle 24.
London Bo, as a Monocle 24.
Lontodan, burası Monocle 24.
Londonist, siin on Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que que nina teiro no a Monocle 24?
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24-tagartja.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. On Monday, the Republic of South Sudan will mark 1 year as an independent nation. The celebrations which greeted independence 12 months ago were long, loud and, on the whole, filled with hope. Civil war with the North had lasted 2 decades and cost some 2 million lives. Independence, many in South Sudan believed, would bring jobs, security and improved education and healthcare. Thanks to an abundance of oil, the new nation was, on paper at least, the richest in East Africa. But 1 year on, few South Sudanese can point to many improvements. Disputes over oil have led to violent clashes with the North and even the closing of oil pumps, something which has had a devastating effect on the country's finances. And something else has had a devastating effect on the country's finances. Corruption. President Salva Kiir last month revealed that $4 billion was unaccounted for. Our senior editor, Sophie Grove, is currently in Juba, the capital of South Sudan, travelling with the Elders, a rogue diplomatic outfit of former presidents and statesmen who are involved in peace talks there. Hello, Sophie.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very good. I hope Juba is treating you well. First of all, let's talk about the Elders who you're with. What is their role here in South Sudan?
So there are three of them here. I mean, they're a collective that includes Nelson Mandela and Kofi Annan when he's not negotiating peace in Syria. But Archbishop Tutu is here, and he's leading the delegation, and Martti Ahtisaari, the former president of Finland, and Mary Robinson, who used to be the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and is also the former president of Ireland. So they're all here, and their role is really to sort of they're trying not to get too involved with the AU, the African Union's talks, which are being led by Thabo Mbeki. And then this morning we started in Addis Ababa, and they met with Thabo Mbeki, and then we flew to Juba, and directly we were met off the plane by a government convoy who swept the presidential palace for some talks with Salva Kiir, who's the president of South Sudan. And they were there for hours. I think what they were really discussing was several things that you touched on in your introduction, but namely trade routes and trying to resolve the border demarcation disputes that have caused a lot of the conflict here once and for all. And you're so right that it is coming up to the 1 year anniversary, and it just feels like there's so much expectation here, and not all of it has been fulfilled, to put it mildly.
You say obviously a lot of that expectation hasn't yet been fulfilled. I mean, do you get a sense from the mood in the city that that people are still willing to give Salva Kiir and his government a bit of time, or is there any sort of sense of growing resentment that money's gone missing, that if you're in a government convoy you may be able to move very quickly through town, but otherwise the roads you're going on might be rather less impressive?
I mean, it's very divided, and I'm at a party at the UN Special Representative's house. The army's here, the archbishop's here, who's been negotiating treaties with several chiefs in the north of South Sudan. The chief of interior's here. They're talking about the sort of cleanup they're doing in the police, because the police is completely bloated and also corrupt. And the cheer, the people are wearing these wonderful shirts that are saying, Independence Day, 9th of July. And it's party. But at the same time, when I was on the plane, the man I sat next to me had these absolute stacks of cash that were being handed out the moment the money from the oil came in. It just all got siphoned off his bank account. So there's a sense that of real injustice there. That was their chance to have a social infrastructure. And the expectations of the people were so high. And there just hasn't been a deliberate, like they haven't delivered. But at the same time, people realise they've been an opposition movement for so long. They haven't actually had a chance to really sort of generate their ideology or sense of what they're actually going to create as a society, as they've done. So I think they are giving them a chance.
Now, as you said, there are some AU, African Union and United Nations talks at the moment between South Sudan and the North, the Khartoum government, about the border, about various disputes around the oil. And as you say, the elders are trying to not really interfere with that. What role can the elders, I mean, I describe them as a rogue diplomatic outfit. I mean, what role can the elders really play in a situation like this?
I mean, the elders really believe in peace. I mean, fundamentally, their experience is huge optimism. They're fighters. You know, Robinson is the president during the Troubles in Ireland, and Archbishop Tutu has led the peaceful protest that ended apartheid. And they are really, that's their message. They believe that peace can be negotiated in any circumstances, and that, you know, the border disputes and the fighting that's going on and the humanitarian disaster that's unfolding is really to do with peace. And so they're trying to nudge. I mean, it's in a way their situation is quite symbolic. They come here, and I mean, Bishop Tutu just inspires so much, almost hysteria, I mean, for what he represents to the African people. I mean, they absolutely adore him, and they've seen him deliver. So I think there's that sense of optimism that they bring is really important to the people of South Sudan.
And in the days leading up to the independence celebrations on Monday, on the 9th, obviously the elders are going to still be around. What are they planning to do, and what will you be doing with them?
So tomorrow we are taking a plane, a helicopter, and then a convoy to the north, a Nile state called Blue Nile, and there's a refugee camp there which is actually just burgeoning. I mean, it's about 100,000 people, and apparently 1,000 people are arriving every week. And it's the rainy season here, so the humanitarian situation is pretty tough. And they're basically looking to highlight that. I mean, it really is a PR stunt in many ways, so to bring the international community's focus onto that. And UNHCR are saying, you know, this is reaching crisis point. And it's this residual fighting that's going on up there, and these people are coming from Sudan, and in the north they consider themselves citizens of Sudan, but they're actually being pushed out by the fighting and fleeing into the south. And it seems like at the moment there isn't really a precedent for too much intervention in terms of a humanitarian role, and that's what they're trying to really further and bring attention to.
Sophie Grove in Juba, thank you very much indeed. And we'll be speaking to Sophie again, and also covering those Independence Day celebrations in South Sudan on Monday morning's Globalist. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up next, we'll be talking about Libya ahead of the first free elections the country has seen in six decades. Stay with us.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25/25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 18:15 here in London. It is 14:15 in Sao Paulo and 10:15 in the morning in San Francisco. Libya will hold its first free elections for 60 years this weekend. How will the country cope with this much-anticipated hurdle on the post-Gaddafi trajectory? And what kind of government could emerge at the other end? To find out more on today's briefing, Monocle's Chloe Potter spoke with Portia Walker, who's currently in Libya.
Tell us, what's the atmosphere like there ahead of this momentous occasion? On the whole, are people relishing this opportunity to change things?
Yes, I think there's a huge sense of enthusiasm as people go to vote, as you say, for the first time in 60 years. But alongside that, there's a lot of people are absolutely baffled because the political system here is extremely complicated. There are thousands of candidates, several hundred parties, and I think a lot of people I've been asking and saying, who are you voting for, what do you want, say, oh, we're very happy to vote, but we're not sure yet who we're going to be voting for.
There's a lack of understanding. I mean, it is a bewildering number of candidates and parties, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's not just that there are so many, it's that the whole system is just so new. Several months ago, many of these parties simply didn't exist. Under Gaddafi, there weren't political parties, were banned. And there are a number of opposition groups that are running, that have a pedigree, you could say, of being opposed to the regime, and as a result can be people are familiar with them. But for the most part, these are totally new entities.
Are the transitional leaders popular? Are they perceived to have been doing a good job?
Well, yes. A lot of people I have spoken to say they like to vote for Mahmoud Jibril, who was, of course, interim prime minister under the National Transitional Council. So I think there is definitely a sense of support for people who are closely involved in the revolution. A figure everyone's going to be watching very closely is Abdelhakim Belhaj, who, as we know, was a former jihadist with links to al-Qaeda, but was also a long-standing opponent of Colonel Gaddafi and a key figure in the military aspect of the uprising.
Portia, not all eligible voters have registered, have they? How engaged are Libyans in the process? And specifically, do you think women are going to represent the 40-odd% that in theory they should?
Well, I think there are a huge number of women candidates to answer that question first. There are posters bearing pictures of women all over the capital. I mean, this is because of a quota, so it remains to be seen how much power women will be able to exert. Initially, women had a greater role in the National Transitional Council, but a number of them felt they were slightly forced out of it. As to the turnout, we're expecting quite a high turnout today. About 80% of the 2.9 million people who have registered to vote. Where there may be tension is in the east of the country. We've seen trouble brewing in the eastern city of Benghazi, which is where the revolution started on February 17th of last year. People there are angry because they're getting a smaller number of seats in the new assembly than they would have liked. There are 200 seats, and they're getting 60 of them, while the west of the country gets 100.
That was Portia Walker speaking with Chloe Potter on the briefing earlier today, and you can listen to the rest of that interview, if you so wish, by visiting our time shift or by downloading the show on iTunes. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And it is 18:19 here in London. The Rencontre d'Arles, now in its 40th year, is the Venice Biennale of photography, attended by big-name photographers as well as photo agencies looking for talent and to do business. But it's not just about parties and big-name launches. The photography school in Arles has a world-class reputation, and much of the festival is devoted to training sessions and workshops. Our executive producer, Gillian De Bias, has been there all week making a film for Monocle.com, and she joins us on the line now from France. Hello, Gillian.
Bonsoir, Steve.
Bonsoir, indeed. So, Gillian, tell us a little bit about some of these workshops, the sort of people who've been organising them and what the photographers have actually been learning at them.
Well, I think what I've been struck by is that often I go to festivals and there's not much participation really by the people who go to these festivals. And what is amazing is with this photography festival, it's not just about appreciating and having a love of photography. You can actually get involved, whether you're at the amateur level or whether you're at the professional level. And so all throughout the whole, well, particularly the opening week, which we've been covering, they have these amazing workshops. And they can be very practical, hands-on workshops where you have the masters of photography going through portfolios of new and emerging professionals. And that is, you know, it's about sharing the knowledge and passing on the baton, which is amazing. You know, it's not protecting your talents and your expertise, but there's a real feel, and I sense in the photography industry, of sharing the knowledge. And so you'll have these incredible photographers just working through photo by photo, analyzing, dissecting, and advising photographers on how to make them different, or how to make them better, or how to make them more publishable and more marketable.
I mean, there is something specific about photography as an industry, isn't it? That there is very much an industry where people share knowledge, where whether you're a young photographer with another young photographer, or whether you're a veteran, passing on knowledge to a younger snapper, that there's a willingness to share, isn't there?
Oh, not just willingness. It's kind of a cause. I was talking to one person and who was saying, you know, you're really struck walking through the streets of either very, very young earnest people or very, very old people, but old people with white beards and fedora hats and camera jackets where you have every pouch filled with different things relating to their work as camera men and photographers, because you do sense that people have been coming for maybe 30 years to this festival who are professional photographers, and there's that sharing of the old guard with the new guard, and they mix together, and it's very inspiring, I have to say.
Now, also at the festival, the pre-Pictet nominees have been, the shortlisted photographers have been on display. The winner is going to be chosen later this year at the Saatchi Gallery here in London. I mean, was there a sense? I mean, I don't know if you got a chance to see the pre-Pictet photos. I mean, was there a sense that this was a particularly strong year?
Well, I think what's interesting about the way they unveil their nominees is they do it in the Antique Théâtre at night. And so it's not in an exhibition space, but really a nighttime event where everyone's sitting in the amphitheater and the crickets are going and it's nighttime. And it's on a big screen. So what I think Pictet want to do is show the power of photography, because the idea behind the Pictet is all about photography that can affect change, and specifically vis-a-vis climate change and the way people think about environmental issues. So to see it on a big screen is, you know, very, very powerful. And I think with all the films that were photographs that were nominated this year, you do sense that immediately they may not be that powerful to look at, but there are layers and layers and layers of ideas behind them, and they're really like almost photojournalists. They really want to tell stories to make people think. So I think that's what's going to be interesting when we see them unveiled and the award announced at the Saatchi Gallery later in the year.
Now, one of the big events at the festival is the thing they call the Night of the Year, which happens tonight. Tell us about this and how it works. It really takes over the town, doesn't it?
It does take over the town, and again, it's that great feeling of festivité, which I think the French do so well in summer. And it's again a sign that it's not insular. They don't want to be photography, and they don't want this industry just to be for insiders. It's really about the city. It's about the people, those that come just for the festival or those who live in it. So they change areas, and every year they take a different area. This is across the river, and they have big screen projections, and they invite the media, they invite newspapers and magazines and small magazines and newspapers to show some of their best work of the year on these huge, massive screens. And it's always, you know, drum roll this evening, because there are also dinners and squares and wine, and so they really use it as kind of like a celebration and a festival.
Gillian de Bias in France, enjoy the Night of the Year, and thank you very much for joining us. And you can see Gillian's film on the Recondal, which she did in conjunction with our culture editor Robert Bound, on monocle.com later this month. You're listening to Midori House.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London is New York, Hong Kong is Tokyo. Sino Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λόντοστα καζίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
Λόντομπο, as a Monocle 28.
Λόντζαδάν, Μπουρασέ, Monocle 24.
Λόντενιστ, σύνο Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que que nina teiro no a Monocle 24?
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, how about ya?
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, here on Monocle 24. The news headlines with James Luckhurst are next. But first, before that, we're going to play a track from a Midori House session recorded a little earlier this year. It's the first song we're playing today, but this is called Second Song, and it's by Angus Stone. And that was a second song by Angus Stone, which he recorded right here at Midori House a little earlier this year. It is 18:29 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be discussing Rajiv Chandrasekaran's new book, Little America, and we'll meet some Swedish neighbours. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says an increasing stream of defectors from the Syrian army are showing that the situation is shifting in the country. Speaking after a meeting of the Friends of Syria in Paris, Mrs. Clinton said she'd been cheered by news of the defection of Army General Manaf Tlass, a personal friend of President Assad. In Germany, senior lawmakers from Angela Merkel's Conservatives have warned of growing resentment at perceived concessions by the government on Eurozone bailout schemes. At the summit in late June, Italy's technocrat Prime Minister Mario Monti and Spanish leader Mariano Rajoy overcame Mrs. Merkel's reluctance to use the bailout funds to stabilise bond markets and directly help the banks of struggling Eurozone countries. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, has said that the IMF's next forecast for global economic growth would be down from the 3.5% predicted in April. She praised EU leaders' efforts to solve the debt crisis, but said that further reforms and strong implementation were needed. Libyans will tomorrow vote in the first free national elections in more than half a century, amid fears that violence could taint the poll that's meant to usher in a temporary national assembly. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court member responsible for the son of former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi has said it would not be possible for him to receive a fair trial in his home country. And Australian Girl Guides have decided to drop references to God and the British Queen from the 50-year-old pledge, choosing instead to be true to themselves and to serve their community and Australia. In changes unveiled this week by the Volunteer Girls Group, members have decided to keep their sashes with badges, but pledges of duty to a Christian God, British monarch and obedience have been consigned to history. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Rajiv Chandrasekaran's last book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, was a shocking investigative tour de force of the farce that was America's occupation of Iraq. As he revealed, the men and women sent to rebuild Iraq were chosen on the basis, often, of their right-wing political beliefs, including their views on abortion, rather than their knowledge of the Middle East. And in one now infamous example, a 24-year-old who had never worked in finance was chosen, as you would, to rebuild the Baghdad Stock Exchange. With his new book, Little America, Chandrasekaran turns his attention to the war in Afghanistan. The revelations are no less alarming. And I'm pleased to say Rajiv Chandrasekaran joins us now live from New York City. Rajiv, welcome to Midori House.
pleasure to talk to you today.
Now, in this book, you detail, you know, huge problems with America's war in Afghanistan, from very serious arguments within Obama's own senior team, to generals dispatching troops to the wrong places, to civilian appointees who, you know, are clearly doing their jobs for the money and don't really want to be there. I mean, what in your mind were sort of the most shocking things that you discovered?
Well, we sent the first waves of the new troops authorized by President Obama to the wrong place, in my view. It's not that Helmand Province, which of course is known very well to the British, was not deserving of some additional force, and there certainly were some serious problems there. But because of tribal infighting in the Pentagon between the U.S. Army and the U.S. Marine Corps, majority of the first wave of forces wound up going to a part of the country with relatively few people, as opposed to places where there was a real genuine risk of a Taliban takeover that could have fully toppled the Afghan government. The civilian surge, which was supposed to unfold in tandem with the military surge, this was a wave of American diplomats and reconstruction workers who were supposed to hit the ground and in tandem with the soldiers, were slow to arrive. Many of them were cantoned in Kabul as opposed to getting out into the field. And many of them, quite frankly, just didn't have the right skill sets to be out there. People who were seeking to make some additional money for working in a war zone or escaping a foreclosed home or a divorce, as opposed to really wanting to be out there to help the Afghan people. And I argue that we flooded the country with simply too much money. It's not that Afghanistan isn't deserving of international assistance. It has, very dire needs. But it was as if we took a and turned a fire hose on a thirsty man, giving him far more than he could reasonably, swallow, and quite frankly, probably harming him along the way. I didn't set out to write this book. I thought that I'd be going to Afghanistan starting in 2009 to write about how the Obama team managed to turn around this war, how they managed to salvage a reasonable outcome after years of strategic drift under the Bush administration. But what I found after repeated trips was, unfortunately, more missteps, not quite the politicized missteps of Iraq, but unfortunately more silly mistakes and more folly of occupation.
I mean, given, what you had discovered in your last book on Iraq, I mean, you say you weren't going there hoping to write this book. You thought you'd end up writing a book about how Obama's administration had perhaps been turning a corner. Were you, in the end, actually quite surprised that so many of the mistakes that were made in Iraq seem to have been repeated in Afghanistan just by different people?
I was, and, these were supposed to be, quite frankly, the best of the U.S. government, the best of the State Department, the reconstruction teams, Pentagon generals, chastened by their earlier experiences in Iraq. I certainly expected better from all of them. And it really does raise a bigger question about America's capacity to do this sort of work and whether any superpower can really be a benevolent occupier and can rebuild these sorts of shattered societies, or whether this is work that really is left, that must be better left to the people of that country with meaningful assistance, but not trying to do it for them.
Do you worry that too many of these mistakes were perhaps made because of, perhaps based on good intentions, or at least based on things that they thought would look good? So it's a good thing if we send in civilians as well as the army. It's a good thing if you're, Barack Obama and you're running for president, if I show that although I'm against the war in Iraq, don't think that I'm scared of war. I'm going to send people into Afghanistan.
Indeed. I think all of these decisions were based on the best of intentions. I don't ascribe any nefarious motives to it at all. But it speaks to the capacity of the U.S. government and, quite frankly, our NATO allies, Britain, our European friends, to deliver on these grand promises. Toward the end of the book, I in one of my several concluding sentences, say that for too long, we focused on the shortcomings in Kabul and Islamabad and not enough on what we were doing wrong in Washington.
I was in Brussels a couple of weeks ago interviewing Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the NATO Secretary General, who claimed that Afghanistan will be seen as a great success. Those were his words. When I repeated them back to him, he try to sort of veer away from them. But there was still a sense of, no, I think we're doing the right thing, and people will understand that in the end. Do you think there's any truth in that? I mean, is that really what senior officials in the US think as well?
I think great success is a bit hyperbolic, quite frankly. Mm. And senior officials in the United States would not go that far if asked the same question. That said, I don't think Afghanistan is going to be a great failure either. I think it's going to be messy. I think it's going to be chaotic. But I don't see the Taliban rolling into Kabul in pickup trucks as they did in the 1990s to simply take over the country yet again with great ease. I think the Afghan government and the Afghan army, as raggedy as it is, will manage to hold on to major population centers, but there will still be attacks. There will still be a degree of violence. It won't look like victory. It won't look like a Jeffersonian democracy, but it won't be helicopters leaving from the roof of the embassy building. At least, look, none of us can predict the future with any great accuracy, particularly not in Afghanistan, but this is sort of my informed guess as to the future. Anybody who can tell you with you know, perfect clarity what's going to happen, I wouldn't bother listening to him.
One of the other similarities between Little America and Imperial Life is that there you do often find the good guys, the people who really know what America should be doing in this country, just no one ever really listens to them. Do you get a sense that maybe that, you know, in Afghanistan, the good guys are starting to be heard a little bit more?
Well, unfortunately, the good guys, as you put it, and I wouldn't disagree with that, but the really brave, heroic men and women who are out there largely at the field level taking great risks to try to make things better in their little patch of sand, they're not really listened to as much because they're generally far away from the capital and they're off doing their own thing as opposed to those who wear coats and ties and sit in the air-conditioned embassy building. So I try to illuminate the work of some of these individuals to show that it's not all disastrous, that there were people there accomplishing great things, but in many cases they were doing it in spite of the rules set down by their bosses, in spite of the standard operating procedures that came down from on high. They were mavericks and rule breakers, but it was just that spirit that led them to actually forge real relationships with the Afghans, meaningfully help people, and try to improve lives in the respective areas in which they were operating.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran in New York, thank you very much for joining us. The book is Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Go and buy it now. And if you haven't read Imperial Life in the Emerald City, go and buy that now too. You're listening to Midori House. We're right back after this.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It's that time of year again when City Hall officials dab their concerned brows and mayors worry if they've raised their game enough to even get a mention. That's because Monocle's bumper annual quality of life survey is hitting newsstands with its ranking of the top 25 cities to call home. Pick up your copy to see whether your town is a magnetic metropolis or a city on the slide. The July-August double issue comes with many more surprises too. From five cities that are never going to win on metrics, but which we love anyway, to 10 surprising leaders you should know, to 50 things to improve your life. And our editors have been busy rounding up many more reports.
In the culture section, we showcase some of our favourite local heroes, from the record shop owner in Bangkok to the newsstand kiosk owner in Milan and the guy with a book truck in Tokyo. We'll also have a cultural calendar with all the best books, music, films and art for the summer ahead.
In the design section, we head to Marina City, a pair of modernist towers that is home to one of Chicago's more interesting communities. and we pack our swimming trunks and costumes and make for Lugano, where we profile this season's swimwear.
You'll find all this and more in the July-August issue of Monocle. It's on newsstands now.
And once you've finished with your July-August bumper issue, which will take some time because it's our biggest, yeah, it's 16 millimetres long, 16 millimetres thick, rather, you'll soon have the Mediterraneo in your hands, our summer newspaper, which we're putting the finishing touches to right now. And I'll be talking to Andrew Tuck, our editor, about that in a little bit. But first, we're going to play some more music. This is the brilliant Daft Punk, and this is Digital Love. That was Daft Punk with Digital Love. Now, Midori House has been its usual hive of activity this week as we've been putting the finishing touches to this summer's edition of the Mediterraneo. The stories have been written, the artwork has been laid out, the facts have been well and truly checked. All that's left, I hope, is a final bit of I dotting and T crossing. Our editor Andrew is still hard at work on the editorial floor, and he joins me now. Hello, Andrew.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm very good. Oh, it sounds quite lively up there.
I think, unfortunately, that some people are watching tennis in the background.
Hard
That's
at
how
work.
Hard working it is up here.
Who's winning? Is Andy Murray winning yet?
I've got a horrible feeling that Andy Murray may have won.
Oh, really?
Yes.
There we are. Live breaking news. Andy Murray has won. Wow. I'm kind of stunned by that now. I don't really want to talk about the Mediterraneo, but let's, Andrew. So aside from watching tennis...
Well, either he's won or he's nearly won.
Oh, okay.
Annoyingly, things are going his way.
Annoyingly.
Yeah, I don't like him.
Oh, really?
Anyway, okay. Moving on.
Moving on. The rest of the office that aren't watching the tennis, how are they doing with Mediterraneo?
Well, you'd think it was almost ready to go, but our editor-in-chief has just slipped away to go to Brisbane, and he owes me a bit of copy.
He was actually just standing in the control room about a minute ago. I just saw him, so I don't know where he sloped
off
to.
He left in a very hurried way when I saw I had headphones on and I couldn't run after him.
Excellent. But aside from that, is he aside from Tyler's missing copy, is everything else gone?
Well, it's almost gone. So it's going to be a kind of a dazzling, sunny newspaper. So,
what are the things we've got to look forward to in it?
Well, we've been everywhere. We sent Sophie Grove up to Baalbek to find out what's... how the kind of crisis in Syria is threatening the famous international festival there. We sent you in a little car.
We did, yes. That was good fun.
Along the coast of Slovenia.
Yes, a very, very short coast. Only 46 kilometres long, that.
It's the shortest coast in the Med.
It is. The shortest coast in the Med / Adriatic, that bit anyway. Yeah, no, that was quite good fun. It looks very good as well. Great photos.
Yeah, and then we've also been to kind of an extraordinary base, which is in on the coast of Tuscany. The US has its own little kind of beach resort. It owns a little chunk of Tuscany where it takes US soldiers for R&R. And we went there to see the kind of lifestyle there. But also there's a serious side to it. That it's where they take many of the troops who have come out from Afghanistan. And it's a kind of reboot, really, for troops who kind of need a bit of sun and need to kind of relax with their families after being in the theatre of war often for very many months.
And have you been anywhere? Did you send yourself anywhere, Andrew?
I sent myself on holiday. That's where I've been. And I also did go to the tennis this week.
You did, yeah. I think you should have been interviewing me about what's been in the Med, because I've been sort of looking after things while you've been away.
Well, let's say looking after is stretching it. I've caught more errors in the few days since I've been back. I can't tell you.
No.
It's all looking fine. So what's interesting is we do these two big resort newspapers every year, and it allows us to kind of go on holiday with our readers, as it were.
Mm.
Well, I'd like to go on holiday with them because they seem to go to nice places. It's going to be coming out in 2 weeks' time, and we focus on the big resorts around the Mediterranean, but you will find it in all good bookstores around the world.
Indeed you will, alongside the July-August issue, which still has some time to stay on the shelves. When we first talked about doing the Mediterraneo, I always call it the Mediterraneo. I know that's wrong.
That's because you're from Birmingham.
It is, yes. When we first talked about doing the Mediterraneo and its sister winter paper, the Alpino, I mean, what was the original thinking behind it, other than you know, you wanted something to do in these 6 weeks between finishing the double issue and starting September.
Hold on, I'm being now distracted by an editor-in-chief who's returned and he's pretending he's tippy-tappy typing and he's not. He's just holding a very empty page that's his page, the one remaining page.
And brilliant.
They have Wi-Fi in BA now.
And, okay, he claims that there's Wi-Fi on his plane, so he's going to be able to send it to us, but I doubt that somehow.
Does that mean that we have to stay until he's done that?
No, because that might be tomorrow.
Okay.
And although I do love this office, I do want to get out at some point as well.
Okay.
But anyway, we did mention Terranio because, again, it's a little bit of testing of the market as well. It was also an attempt to show that you can do things with newsprint, with the newspaper format, that actually defy this idea that print is dead. And we also love the fact that, you know, it's not like an electronic device where you kind of have a little screen that you're squinting at in the sun. We don't care with this newspaper if you drop it in the pool or if you get kind of suntan all over it. It will just look better. And it will be something kind of, it's giant as well. So when you're on your lounger this summer, if you have it perched in front of you, it's going to be a bit of a statement. And also you can watch people from behind it.
You can. And also my favourite bit is there's a tiny little cartoons of all of us. With funny little names that some comedian in the office has written.
this is one of my favourite things of the year. I can right wrongs and take revenge. This is we redo the masthead at the front of the magazine. Everyone loses their traditional job title, and there's a new hierarchy that appears. It should be depending on seniority, but it actually just depends on how well people would behave. So I won't say who's been. Put down as doing one-on-one language lessons.
Yes, I saw that one.
But he knows who he is. And I won't reveal who's actually running the wine shop. She knows who she is. But anyway, all those people have their reputations trounced by me in like 5 minutes.
Excellent.
And it's good fun.
Good. Okay, Andrew Tuck on the editorial floor. Thank you very much. I'll be back up there in 7 minutes to help you out, although it seems like everyone's watching tennis anyway. You're listening to Midori House.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
Now, one of the things we love about Marylebone, our home here, is its international flavour and flair. From a smattering of embassies to a range of restaurants owned by Lebanese and Italian, Ethiopians and French, the languages you hear on the streets around Midori House are rarely English. Every Friday on this show, we like to nip outside and meet the neighbours. And in this week's report, we head to Totally Swedish, a shop which, as the name suggests, does a fine line in crisp bread and herring.
Totally Swedish, Julia speaking.
My name is Anna-Karin Andreasson and I work as a shop manager for Totally Swedish. We've been here for 6 years in August. The owner is Swedish and she was another Swedish store here before and it went for sale and she thought this is a good opportunity and she bought it. In London there is around 60,000 Swedes, so we sell Swedish food for all the Swedes in London. Salty licorice, and then also meatballs, herring, and sour milk. But then we also do like some towels, designs, and books. Most of them are in Swedish, and some in English as well, by the Swedish author like Astrid Lindgren. And also, like you said, small moccasins for babies. That's very Swedish. Everything isn't Swedish, but it is what Swedes like and what you can't get hold of in the UK. We opened another second shop in August last year, and also I think the Swedish food have been more, or Scandinavian food have been more introduced in the UK as good food, so we get more English people in during the last 2 years. And also we opened an online shop for 4 years ago, so we now send food to Edinburgh and all around the UK. We have the cinnamon buns, for example. They come in fresh on Tuesday and Thursdays, and then we put them in the freezer and people just love them. Swedes or English or wherever you're from, they love the cinnamon buns. And then we have the sour milk that we can't really be without, because if we don't have them, the Swedes got a bit annoyed. And that's like Swedish yogurt, but nicer. And then we also have like the hats for Olympic Games and everything else that Sweden is competing in. The summer is otherwise our low season. Our high season is Christmas and midsummer, and that passed now, so yeah, it's slow, but hopefully it's getting better because of the Olympics. Four times a year we get in like homemade sort of herring in like plastic jars, and it's very, it's homemade, so it's nicer and people like that a little bit extra. And then also the aquavit, it's like vodka with spices. You have it with all dinners in Sweden, and especially for midsummer and the crayfish party and Christmas. Our area is nice. We have the Swedish church around the corner, and the Swedish embassy, and the Swedish pub as well, actually. So there's loads of Swedes walking past every day.
That was Wonderful Neighbours at Totally Swedish. And that is it. Everything we have for this episode of Midori House, indeed, this week's worth of Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Alex Jakes. A little bit later, in fact, right after this, right after the news, we're going to have this week's episode of The Menu. And today we learn that Professor Paul Rosen will be telling us all about how to make a meal memorable.
Just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal. But there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
And in 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, the Monocle Daily will be here. Over the weekend, of course, don't forget the review, and don't forget this week's Monocle Weekly, and of course the curator, that's on both Saturday and Sunday. But for me, here in Midori House, that's all we've got time for. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.